This week on Basic Black, Boston 2030, a long-range vision for Boston. Will the mayor's aspirational dreams for the city on the hill be derailed by the on-the-ground issues of affordable housing and persistent racial wealth disparities? And how will this plan be for Boston's future recognize the needs of communities of color? That's our conversation coming up.
Our panel tonight, Philip Martin, senior reporter, WGBH News. Jerome Smith, chief of civic engagement, City of Boston. Callie Crossley, host, Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, 89.7 WGBH. Ayanna Presley, Boston City Councilor at Large. And John Barrows, chief of economic development, City of Boston. To join the conversation, please visit our website at basicblack.org.
Yeah, who was telling me to shut up?
So the last time Boston thought in a long-range way about what the future would be was 50 years ago. And now we're talking about engaging in a two-year initiative called Boston 2030 that's going to look forward and be ready to be actualized for the 400th birthday of the city. This is a huge deal when you start thinking about master planning and all that it involves. So, John Barrows, I have to kick it off with you. When you say Boston 2030, what does that mean to you?
Boston 2030 is an opportunity for all of us to think about our city. What it might mean to us. And being a native Bostonian, somebody who was born and raised in Roxbury, I didn't always see Boston as my city. I didn't always see all of Boston as, it kind of felt like Roxbury and actually a few blocks in Roxbury. Becoming older and more mature, this city has a lot to offer. And imagine engaging young people in Boston today to say, how does your Boston look in 2030? And I think we're going to hear some interesting things, not only about what the buildings should look like and what kind of businesses we should have, but how people should act, who's respected, you know, what are we doing to make sure everyone's included, who owns the businesses. And I think that's the kind of vision we're looking for. We're looking for a vision that helps us set the physical build out for the city, that helps us set the policy framework for the city, and helps people in City Hall and all over the city to be united in terms of where we're going together.
What do you hear when you hear Boston 2030, Ayanna Presley?
I see it as a prompt, an impetus, and an opportunity to engage people in a meaningful way as stakeholders in the visioning of their city. And I love that Chief Barrows underscored that this is about so much more than bricks and mortar and development. This has everything to do with culture and climate and dynamics. So the other thing that excites me about it is the opportunity to engage more than just the usual suspects, to go outside of this. We tend to sometimes be engaging the same people over and over again. And so it does lend itself to an opportunity for us to engage a diversity of stakeholders. And I think it's the best kind of partnership in that it empowers community, it is community driven, and ultimately will be something that is government endorsed, but community led. And I think that's the sort of symbiotic partnership that government should be in with community.
Jerome, you have a tough job in this because if every voice should be heard or as many as we can, then how do you get them to the table or get them to the ears of those folks that should be engaged, as Councillor Presley has stated?
Councillor Presley, that's a good point. Our current process in which we go through to engage residents has always been the typical like town hall style, and it's always the same individuals that we go to. So we've been sitting and thinking about what other ways that we actually can get out and talk to the residents that are other than that situation where you have just two microphones and a row full of listeners and the plan's already up on a screen, and that's not buy-in, and that's not actually taking from the community and actually giving back to actually affect the plan. It's more of them kind of nibbling at the edges of something that's already been created. So what we've been talking about is actually scrapping that whole process and actually going out, doing charrettes.
What's a charrette?
A charrette's where you bring a bunch of people in and you kind of give them an overview of what the concept of what we're trying to accomplish today. And you break them off into smaller groups and then have people just run in dialogue and facilitators who aren't telling the small group what to think or what to say, but they're just moving conversation along, throwing pieces in for people to digest and debate, and then there's a scribe that will write down comments. It happens in certain sections of the city. It doesn't happen everywhere, but we need to bring this kind of, you know, togetherness where everybody is like sitting and talking. And, you know, the parochialism of Boston's a little bit, we kind of stay in our neighborhoods, like John said, like Roxbury, everybody felt like Roxbury is Roxbury. Well, we have to think of a way, how do we get everybody from the different neighborhoods into one place, and not just one place, but like multiple places, but get them in a room and you give them a number, and then all of a sudden you say, all right, all the number fours are going to go to this room. You show up in that room, now you're from Roxbury, now you're in Rosendale. The room is Rosendale. And you get to sit and talk about what's affecting Rosendale, what's going on. And then you get to give your viewpoint of what your life in Roxbury, well, I think Rosendale could do some of the things that we do over there. And then people over here, and it's just a way for everybody to get out of their little comfort zone, but also to talk about and start creating ownership of the larger city. And that's the whole point of what I would like to get at, is getting at that whole Boston is for everybody. Because when one neighborhood does well, the other neighborhood does well, and it's this little catalyst. But so it's going to be an interesting little plan that we pull together.
So, Philip, as a reporter who's been to many places in the city and also reported about widely different visions of how people live and how they believe they live and how they believe other people live, what's the importance of a plan that tries to bring everybody's vision to the table, particularly with regard to communities of color?
Because you have to change the psychic feeling of the city of Boston. For years, the salient issue that defined Boston was race, and it's still race to some degree. But I think a more overwhelming issue right now is income inequality. I think that's the issue that really defines the city. I think it's the issue that exacerbates many of the problems that we see in the city, where people feel they're being pushed out, and quite a few people are, because they can't afford the city. The mayor of a few weeks ago, I sat down with other reporters, he gave a quarterly report on housing progress in the city and looked at a number of low-income housing targets that are being met, looked at middle-income targets that where there's some hopefulness that the middle income can continue to thrive in Boston. And what was interesting about this was, in fact, that some of these goals are indeed being met. The housing goals that were articulated in October 2014, the mayor said by 2030 we want to have this amount of housing, 53,000 units of housing. And in the first quarter, we want to have this number. Well, some of those goals have been met. My concern I think that we should applaud that because it is a glimmer of hope for the middle class and for low-income folks. Mm-hmm. My concern is that there still may be, where we had race as the salient issue before, income inequality may still be the salient issue if the city is sectionalized by income. Because on one hand, you have extraordinary progress, again, happening in a number of our neighborhoods. But then you have the seaport, which the mayor talked about, and the mayor essentially conceded that the seaport, some of the construction that's gone on there, some of the construction that's going on there now, is out of reach of middle-class people and lower middle-class people, and it may be for a long time. But we don't want that to be, we don't want to see in 2030 where one neighborhood is accessible to people of color, to low-income people, and another neighborhood is not accessible. That is, and I think that the goal, of course, is not to let that happen. And so I think that there are some alternatives to that reality. The reality right now is that a few people can afford $6,500 a month in rent, which is what one of the buildings that's being constructed at this very moment is going to cost you.
Okay, so you've thrown down the gauntlet with regard to housing, which is chief piece of this moving forward as we think about 2030. And to your point, the mayor has spent a fair amount of time envisioning that. And Ayanna, I know that you have been quite concerned in this configuration that young people, after all, the planning done now by the folks who are brought to the table are really for the folk coming afterwards. And what we know now, relative to what Philip has just said, is that young people cannot afford to stay here. So we're brain draining, you know, as we try to look forward. How can a 2030 plan, you know, what element do you think of that plan can help retain that and also begin to address some of these income
inequality? I have to say there are some intangibles here. Mm-hmm. When we talk about the brain drain, people are quick to make that about jobs and affordable housing. But I don't want us to lose sight of the earlier point that was made relative to culture. You know, we can do everything we desire to and strive to do to improve the quality of life, but ultimately, this has to be a city that all people and young people want to put roots in and make a life in. And that has everything to do with a sense of community and connectedness. So one of the things I appreciate is that before we formally embark upon this, we are surveying how do people receive their information? Mm-hmm. Because that has also been one of the challenges. Right. This is the opportunity for us to, in fact, instead of recycling old paradigms, to recognize that we have an opportunity to usher in a new one. And this is the time to reinvent the wheel. In government, we continue to struggle with what are the most effective ways with which to reach and engage people, right, given socioeconomic, the stratification of economies, and given language barriers and so many other things. So one, I think it's key that we are surveying how do people receive information, how do they want to receive information. Mm-hmm. Secondly, when it comes to our youth, I have to commend our mayor that this is the second budget cycle that we will have a participatory budget process of $1 million where young people get to come together and determine how those funds should be dedicated and allocated to support them in their own development and advancement. But
let me underscore that. They're going to get to make suggestions about how we spend this money.
Correct.
Just so people realize,
yes,
it's real money and
it's
they get
real.
To put
it's
put
it. It's not Monopoly.
Right,
it's
exactly.
It is
right.
real.
Right.
You know, it is real. And so, you know, I think that's important. But the community and the culture piece is so critical to this. I love that the chief was referencing the need for us to break these bigger rooms down into smaller rooms. You know, in order for people to do or to be in business with anyone, they must first be in good relationship.
Right.
And we are not in good relationship. And you go into these big spaces that are supposed to lend themselves to a democratic process, and it becomes intimidating groupthink. Mm-hmm. And if anyone has a divergent or opposing view, they don't feel it's even a safe space for them to say, you know, actually, I want a bicycle shop there. Mm-hmm. I really think that Roxbury could benefit from that. But they're afraid. Mm-hmm. I want to see more arts and culture here, you know, and so I think, you know, having those smaller groups will support that. So, but the participatory budget process, I think, is a step in the right direction. And again, our surveying, how do people, especially young people, receive information? And then finally, I can't underscore how critical it is that we are being intentional about fostering and building a climate that is inclusive and welcoming, that all people, but in particular young people, want to make roots and make a life here.
And Kelly, I think just to underscore that, that goes to the branding of the city. You know, mm-hmm. This is an economic development imperative. There was a study conducted recently, I think sponsored by Massport and the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center, BCEC, where they surveyed likely African-American travelers, likely Latino travelers, gave them 10 cities, Boston mm-hmm. being one of them, mm-hmm. and said, rank them. Most likely to travel to. Boston ranked dead last for African Americans and almost dead last for the Latino community. And then when the secondary question was asked why, the answer was because of the racial tension that dominates the Boston brand, mm-hmm. the Boston identity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's costing us money, right? They then did the next piece, which is how much money is Boston losing from tourism, conventions, large-scale events, because people do not want to travel here because of that negativity. We need Boston 2030 to help drive a different image, a different branding, and understand the culture we are celebrating that keeps young people here, that keeps people of color here, because the next community that talks about sort of that brand is the corporate community, where they can't mm-hmm. attract, and they say this all the time, they can't yeah. attract talent of color. Right. If they can't attract,
and they can't retain if they do attract, yes.
And that's a problem.
Right.
So how do we think about the social infrastructure of a city that creates a different brand for young people, right? And as we think about the innovation economy and the startup economy, we talk about this all the time. Mm-hmm. What does Boston need to look like, feel like, so that we can have a robust startup economy? What does Boston need to feel like and look like so we can have a robust community of color, robust professional community of color, robust families of color, right? So these are questions we need to ask as we think about a vision of a city that's inclusive, everybody prospers, and that thinks about equality from an income standpoint and a wealth generation standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Well, can I just say, mm-hmm. if we want buy-in from communities of color, we have to address what is a deficit of trust, from generations of really broken promises. You know, we have to be honest about that. You know, I've always maintained that if someone is skeptical, you know, the greatest, those that are the most apathetic, it comes from an informed place, an experience that is real. Mm-hmm. And usually if you can offer them a scenario and a situation with meaningful and thoughtful intervention by government, you can redeem government in their eyes and get their partnership, and they'll engage again. But if they're cynical about this, it's very difficult to get folks when they're cynical. But they're cynical for a reason. So, you know, whatever planning happens, we just need to make sure that we get to a place of implementation and actualization, and that people do not feel that they've been engaged in a process that is a pro forma exercise that will never see the light of day.
Which brings me back to you, Jerome. Mm-hmm. So how do you get people to get over this hump of lack of trust so that they don't feel like you're just somebody collecting some information that's going in a file?
I think we have to acknowledge what the things that they have already worked on previously. I think that when you look at some of the communities of color, they have a lot of, particularly in development and other issues, they have had a lot of civic engagement, and they have a lot of plans. There are a lot of different plans that are sitting on shelves. And that's what I think the counselor is, one of the things the counselor is referring to is that people spend all this time and they do all this work and they say, finally something great's happening in my neighborhood, and then the plan gets shelved. And then there's no acknowledgement of why it's been shelved, it's just been kind of, and then all of a sudden, a few years later, come down the bone, like, we're gonna do another plan. Hmm. And then there's some new people that are in the mix, but then some of the older individuals and leaders in the neighborhood said, wait a minute, 10 years ago we did this. And we talked about that. So when John and I were talking about this and with the counselor is, you know, this is a general plan. It's an overall, but it needs to acknowledge and recognize the previous work that individuals have done. And I think that that is key to us to acknowledge, yes, you have done a great amount of work and a great amount of effort here. And we want to incorporate some of that and freshen it up. Maybe some of the things can change, you know, economies have changed, situations have changed, but the ultimate base is there. So how do we take what you have done previously and acknowledge it in this overall general plan?
Well, let me just say this, just two things I want to pick up from what you just said, but one, very obviously, because it's right in the headlines now, is Boston 2024. Mm-hmm. And Marcella Garcia of the Boston Globe did a piece saying, all this talk, nobody's talking to communities of color, who, by the way, are in the majority, about how they feel about it coming. Mm-hmm. And the only reason to bring that up in this conversation is that 2024 has a great amount of impact, one way or the other, of what's going to happen 2030. In terms of both how people think about planning, in terms of how people think about government and trust and transparency, and about a vision of the city.
The city has been talking about this Boston 2030, or creating a citywide plan, before the Boston was designated for to be considered for the U.S. for the Olympics. And if you look at the timing, we are actually looking to craft a plan before the IOC even designates who the winning host city is going to be. Once we have this plan in place and we have real buy-in and real residents invested, 2024 is going to have to follow this plan. We're not following 2024's plan. 2024 will follow the residents' plan.
I got that part. I'm zeroing in on the fact that whatever happens with them, they have not paid attention to the voices from communities of color. Right. Here we are.
And you see Cali, which is why I think there's been some leadership change. There's been some conversations. There's an effort to re-engage, right? And what I will say, though, is make sure if there is a meeting, there was a meeting held in Roxbury that was jam-packed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's right.
Right.
Yep.
Let's not underscore the fact that people have shown up and had a conversation raised some real concerns.
Right.
There have been some real concerns raised in the communities of color. Mm-hmm. Not enough engagement, right? And so now the question is not just engaging and talking to people in the community of color, but can 2024 hear the issues and respond to and look differently and come back to the community in a different way, right? So there's a journey. We're on a journey. But let's say we don't get the bid, right? Which is a high possibility.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That we don't get the bid. This is the first time we're bidding. Right? We seem to have some problems getting off the block a little bit, mm-hmm, right? And so let's say we don't get the bid. What Jerome says is really important. This is about an opportunity for us to have a conversation about the future of Boston, right? This is an opportunity for us to talk about where we are going despite 2024. If we get 2024, then 2024 should help us accelerate towards there. But 2024 should not be dominating the conversation. So I don't want people to think that it is a more important conversation to be in the 2024 conversation than it is to be in this conversation. This conversation will set the tone for 2024, because without the city, there is no bid.
No, I hear you. I'm just pointing out that if in this instance we are not seeing an engagement at a deep level, whatever happens to the bid, then we're back to where Councilor Presley is. Where is the trust? Now, you're talking all this stuff, but you all didn't come to ask me what
sure
I thought.
Let's just make sure that 2024 is not government.
No, I get it.
I'm not running it. Jerome's not running it.
But there are, you know.
2024 is a nonprofit organization.
It's a city-branded. You know what I'm saying?
Part of the concern, I mean, I think your point is right, because part of the concern right now is that this very term, civic engagement, as you pointed out, has been at a minimal. It has happened, and it is happening. And I think this is a good opportunity to also mention the Rockefeller Fund grant. That was given to the city of Boston to basically engage folks in this conversation. I don't think it's been formulated how that money's going to be spent yet. Am I correct?
Well, they haven't hired the chief person.
That's right. And but I know that. But
and it's a grant about resilience.
That's right. It's a grant about resilience.
Yes. And 100 resilient cities.
Yeah. And because I think a lot of what we're seeing with Boston in terms of what we call progress has both been a result of planning, but it's also been a result of serendipity. And by that I mean this. It's I find it intriguing that when you think about Boston in the 1980s, for example, you still had, it wasn't just a question of a branding, it was actually real fear, where folks were afraid to cross from one neighborhood into another neighborhood. I find something interesting, and that's also tangible these days, which is that I'm seeing less fear among people my generation. I'm seeing almost no fear among younger people in terms of going from neighborhood to neighborhood. And I think it's ironic that the reason that's happened in large part, and I say it's ironic because of the very divisive nature of gentrification, but it's because of gentrification made some neighborhoods accessible, which is quite ironic. When you think about a place like the North End in the 70s, less Chinatown, but the North End of South Boston, Charlestown, these neighborhoods in some ways were impenetrable. Certainly at nighttime for many people of color during the 80s and 70s, fights constantly, fear. The 90s it eased. A lot of that was planning. Give credit to Ray Flynn for a lot of that. You can give credit to Mel King for a lot of that. But I think where we are now is you're crossing that racial crisis mark. I wouldn't say crossing it entirely, because there's still the perception.
Yeah.
But right now,
people aren't afraid to go to these.
That's right. Aren't afraid. Yeah. And what we're seeing now, as I mentioned earlier, is a class divide. And that is less it's less stuffy. It's less smothering because you can find yourself walking into these neighborhoods. The question is, can you afford to buy at a restaurant in those neighborhoods?
The class divide are still along racial lines.
Yes, that's certainly true.
The median net worth of a white family in Boston is $250,000.
That's right.
The median net worth African American family in Boston is $8.
That's right.
And so, so the divide around the wealth gap, and that's just from a report from the Boston Feds.
Right.
So the Boston Federal Reserve Bank. The wealth divide is still around families. You made a comment about gentrification maybe moving us to safety.
Well, I'm saying ironically, but
Be careful,
and
right?
Because the gentry's
not going to save our neighborhood.
No.
That's right.
So 46% of Boston families would be in trouble if there was a disruption in income.
That's right.
In fact, 46 of Boston families would fall below the federal poverty line if there was a disruption in income.
So income inequality.
That's right.
69% of African-American families would fall under the poverty line if there was a disruption in income. 76% of Latino families.
So can I just say something about that?
Hold on one second. Okay. I just want to let everybody know that we're continuing this conversation online. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry, Chief, go on.
No, go ahead. I mean, I think my point, and I'll just be, the conclusion is, that you're right, that the income inequality, which is not just a Boston phenomenon, is a national phenomenon, but unfortunately Boston's leading on a lot of these disparities, are along the racial lines, and then the racial reality of that continues to perpetuate the racial tension branding that Boston has had.
Exactly, which is what I was saying when I say ironic, the notion
well
of being
put.
Able to penetrate these neighborhoods, but yet can't afford these neighborhoods.
Right.
And being forced out of town.
That's right.
Literally, quite often, where people are moving to the South Shore, People are moving to parts of Randolph, for example. More and more people are moving from the city into Randolph, where Roxbury, large clumps of Roxbury, as we now see along Mass Avenue and heading north on Washington Avenue, no longer affordable. Land is being bought left and right. And the question becomes, the vision for that, will that be stemmed by the planning that we're seeing in the context of 2030?
You wanted to say, Ayanna?
I'm trying to think where I want to parachute in. I think I just want to also just acknowledge the challenging realities based upon those statistics that John was sharing. It's challenging to engage people in a planning process and a vision when folks are just trying to survive. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you have people that are not participating because they don't feel they have been invited to participate. Mm-hmm. They question themselves if they have something of value to contribute. Mm-hmm. And there are real reasons they feel that way. There are systemic things set up.
To continue the conversation, see past episodes, or discover new stories, please visit our website at basicblack.org.
Centers, yeah. Which I do think are going to be a game changer in getting at this wealth and the wealth inequalities. Also, what's happening on the federal level and the state level and the city's program around the earned income tax credit that has put millions of dollars back into communities. Mm-hmm. By expanding the eligibility there and educating families about those opportunities. But the last thing that I want to say is I just want us to be careful. It's probably because now I'm 41 and I'm closer. I'm no longer technically a young professional, but I do want to make sure it's easy. When we talk about innovation, to only talk about the waterfront, we want to make sure we're talking about neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so this is about human capital and that opportunity for creative economy and innovation in every way exists within our neighborhoods, but also that this needs to be a city that is not just about people in the prime of their life and is not.